Golf Smarter number 213 for January 12, 2K10.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Building your emotional muscles with John Haim.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for downloading a new episode of the Golf Smarter Podcast. Clearly, I'm still experimenting on how to say the date at the top of the show. I'm kind of lazy, so 2010 takes too long for me. 2010 is good, but I kind of like 2K10. I always had an issue on what to call the last decade. You know, like we had the 90s, we had the 80s, and then the iPod generation, the aughts, the 2000s. But as far as I'm concerned, the best thing to call it is over. Today's show is brought to you by Golf Smarter for members only. We have over 200 episodes of interesting golf content, and you're invited to join and gain full access to every single show. Also, as a Golf Smarter member, you are automatically entered in our drawings and are eligible to be entered in every drawing more than once. I bring that up because we have an awesome drawing going on right now. I'll give you the full scoop on that right after today's interview. And our guest today is John Haim, who played tour golf for 6 years around the world before realizing what he really could or couldn't accomplish as a professional golfer. We talk a lot about developing your mental game on the Golf Smarter podcast, but John contends that success has more to do with your emotional state to enhance your performance in golf or in business or even in life than we realize. He also has a great yet painful story about his most humbling moment on the tour. Crack me up. His book is called You Are a Contender, using Skype from Canada. Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, John.
Thanks, Fred. Great to be here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sending me your book, You Are a Contender. I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to review it before we had a chance to speak. I really wanted to talk to you about your experience in tournament golf. Tell me, you know, what level you achieved and what kind of success you had once you got there.
Sure. Well, I'm a Canadian, and we grew up around golf, my brother and I, because my dad was a golf professional. He was a golf professional for 40 years at the same club in Canada, one of the top private clubs called the Ottawa Hunt and Golf Club. And my brother now is one of the top golf instructors in Canada. So we've been around golf our whole life. We played as kids. And it's funny too, Fred, because when we were growing up, it really wasn't cool to play golf. Now it's a bit more cool to play golf because of the emergence of Tiger and a number of other factors. But, you know, we both played golf through high school. We both showed some promise. I showed some promise, I guess, in my 16th or 17th year. I won a bunch of tournaments. In fact, in my 17th year, I won every tournament I played in the summer months. So,
Wow.
I attracted some interest from some universities.
After you won all those tournaments, was it then cool to be playing golf?
I don't think so. The girls just didn't seem to like me still. So I had to push it further. I had to push the envelope, Fred.
Oh, but when you said it's not cool, it's because of the girls or because guys were giving you a hard time? Because I imagine in Canada where everyone's got a hockey stick.
Well, exactly.
And you're carrying a putter. That they're going to give you physically, they could give you a hard time.
Well, in high school, it just wasn't at that time in the late 70s, early 80s. It wasn't cool for kids to play golf or young people to play golf. If you grew up at a golf club or your parents played, it was kind of cool, but there was relatively no interest in golf as there is today. I mean, the interest today is exponentially more than it was then. So, kids in high school played football, they played basketball, and we did some of those things too. But we started to focus on golf because we showed some promise in it, and we thought that maybe there might be an end game in this whole thing.
So
that was great, and I ended up settling on a school in Indiana called Purdue University. And that was great. Went through 4 years and graduated and had a great experience and had some success in college, won some tournaments in college and was all conference in a couple of the years. So decided that I was going to turn professional. And I did that in 1986. I went through the Canadian PGA qualifying school, and I was fortunate enough to win that and finish first in it. So my plan was to go and play tournament golf, and the winning the tour school gave me a card to play basically anywhere I wanted except for the PGA Tour and the European Tour. So I kind of carted myself and my golf clubs off to Australia and lived there for about a year, played the tour over there, and then over the course of the next 6 years, I played tournaments everywhere. I played the Canadian Tour, I played the South African Tour, I played the Asian Tour, I played the Australian Tour again. You know, I played some satellite circuits in the United States and played a lot of golf over the 6 years, but never truly got to where I wanted to go, which was obviously everybody's dream, which is the PGA Tour in the United States. And I went through the qualifying school, got to the second stage. And after my 6 year, I decided that was it. I it becomes a financial crunch a little bit too when you're playing professional golf. And there was a bit of a financial crunch for me I was just disappointed and down, I guess, that I didn't get to where I wanted to go after that amount of time. I thought I could do it. Mm-hmm. And so so that was it. So that was that's my background in golf.
Well, I'm curious, if you don't mind me asking, in the 6 years that you were touring around different countries, playing in different tours, what level of success did you achieve?
Well, I had some top five finishes in tour events. I was good enough to do that. I never won a tour event. I had a lot of good finishes, but this is where the book comes in, and this is where a lot of the stuff that I do around performance comes in. I never got close to where I thought I should be. And just a quick story. When I first went to Australia, I played in the first two tournaments over there. And you know what? I played quite well. I made the cut in both. And had some success and made a little money and kind of thought to myself, hey, this professional golf thing's a piece of cake, you know, I'm gonna no problem.
So easy squeezy.
Oh, this is easy. Yeah, the scary, that's a bad word, easy. Don't ever say that. So then the third tournament was totally different in that we moved to the big city, we moved to Melbourne. Greg Norman, who was the number one player in the world, showed up at this particular tournament and everything changed. The dynamic of everything on the tour change because, you know, Norman was the guy. He was the savior in Australia. He was the best in the world. He was charismatic. He was really something. The first time I stood next to him, I couldn't believe it. I mean, he looked like some sort of a god or something, you know? So, yeah, and I the first couple of rounds of that tournament, I played very well.
Yeah, that's got to be so intimidating and have such an impact on your game.
Oh, for a young person especially, Fred, it's crazy. Especially, you know, I drove in my 1970 Toyota Corolla and Greg Norman flew in a helicopter and landed right beside the first tee. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can tell.
It was okay because, you know, I was very nervous the first couple of rounds, but Norman was kind of playing at the other end of the draw and I could kind of go about my business a little bit and you know, we shot the same score or one off from each other after two rounds. So the third round, I go out there and there's people everywhere, Fred. It's chock-a-block. I swear half the city of Melbourne was out watching. They predicted 30 to 40,000 people. So I'm going from, you know, a tournament that has 500 people now to nothing I've seen before with 40,000 people. So I get out there and I go into the locker room and I change my shoes and my hands are shaking tying my shoes. So that can tell you how nervous I was. And then I went out to the driving range and wasn't real focused because I was practicing two down from Norman. So I was spending more time watching him. And I got up on the first tee and didn't hit a very good tee shot and started off not very well. And Greg was playing right behind me in the group behind me. And you know, this is where this whole idea that we can talk about here, the whole idea of emotions and what emotions can do to you. And my emotions were knocking me all over the place on the golf course. And I got around and I was about four or five over par, I think, coming to not very good because I'd throw all the shots that I had picked up in the first two rounds, I had given all back already in the third round. So I get to the last hole and it's about a 440-yard par four, and there's people lined 10 deep down both sides right to the grandstand behind the green at the end of the hole. And I get up on the tee, and I'm beside myself nervous because I can see how many people there are. And it's like I almost close my eyes, but I hit this great tee shot off the tee, smoked it right down the middle. It was into a little breeze. And we get down there, and we're waiting for the green to clear. And by this time, Norman has come up on the tee, and he's waiting for me to hit my shot. And I can see the blonde hair flowing in the wind, you know, and everybody's buzzing because no one gives a hoot about what I do on the hole. They're waiting for him. So my caddy says we've got about 200, 205 to the flag. And it's into a little breeze. You're a bit pumped up. So I said, what do you think about a 3-iron? He said, yeah, I think that's the one. I think you should hit the 3. So I get over it, and I'm in a complete blank. My mind's blank. I can't see anything. And I hit this wild duck hook into the crowd. Okay, and it goes into the crowd, and it hits a man in the shoulder, this older man. So I walk over there, and this older man has got his shirt rolled up, and there's this big golf ball welt on his shoulder, okay, and now the crowd's kind of buzzing, and the marshals are saying, "Oh, people, clear back. He's got to hit his next shot," and I've got not that hard of a shot into the green. I mean, it's a shot I've hit a million times. It's about 60 yards to the flag, and I take a couple of practice swings. I try to make myself look good, you know, in front of all the people and everything. And again, I'm not focused on the shot at all, and I take the swing, and I hit this wicked skull blade, and it goes in the crowd in the grandstand and hits this lady in the leg. Okay?
I'm sorry. So now, comedy of errors. I don't
need ahead.
To be laughing
yeah, go ahead
for that
laugh.
Lady.
It is pretty funny. So now I'm back in the gallery, and the Aussies have been drinking beer all afternoon, and I'm getting the comments, right, from the Aussie crowd. Go back to Canada. Of course, I've got the big Canadian flag on my bag. They know exactly who I am. They're calling my name. And the guys up at the top at the grandstands are saying, "Are you done yet, mate?" And, you know? So now I've got to drop a ball. Now I've got to drop a ball at the edge of the, you know, back away from the green, just off the edge of the green. I've got about 100 feet down to the flag. The flag's on the front left.
And is Greg Norman's presence just looming over you at this point?
Oh yeah, well he's walking
among
up
other
the fairway.
Things?
Yeah, he's walking up the fairway to his next shot, and you know, people are just thinking to themselves, "Get this guy out of here. We just want to see Greg hit the next shot." So I have this 100.
Oh no, you are so much more entertaining because he's going to hit the ball, put it in the middle of the fairway, put the ball on the green, one maybe two putt, and he's gone. Right? You're entertaining. This is fun, especially for a drunk
beer.
Crowd.
Yeah, for the guys drinking beer, I guess I was pretty entertaining. So then I go to hit the next shot. It's an easy shot. All I have to do is get it rolling on the green. It'll roll down the flag somewhere, and I hit about 6 inches behind it, and I flub it about a foot. And now I got to hit the same shot, and I sort of fluffed it a bit again and then hit it too far, almost over the green, and took two or three putts and ended up making an 8 or a 9 on a par 4 on the last hole and embarrassing myself to absolutely no end. So just went down and sat in a, you know, after I signed my scorecard, sat in a little ball of depression trying to figure out just what happened, you know?
Probably one of those portable urinals, right? The portable toilets.
That's where I should have been so no one could laugh at me on the way by. There's that guy. He just made 9 on 18. But, you know, and so that was a real, when I look back on my career, my career was quite inconsistent in that some weeks I was okay and other weeks I wasn't okay.
Sure.
I let
golf.
The emotion. Yeah, that's golf, but it's also, I always, not always, but many times I let the emotions, mm-hmm. my emotions inside of me, get the best of me. And when you're performing, you just cannot do that. You have to be in control.
Sure.
And
sure.
Did Greg Norman,
did you have any contact with him after the round, after he finished 18?
Yeah, he kicked sand in my face.
Come on.
No, I'm just kidding.
What a class act.
But you know what? I did play with him on two occasions. I played with him like as the tour went on. I played with him in a real round, and I played with him in a practice round. And it was a little bit better, but it was still – I was still very, very uncomfortable. In the practice round, not so much. In the real round, when the pressure was on, very uncomfortable.
Did either of you bring up that moment? No way.
No, because you know what, Fred? When I think about it, at that time, I didn't really realize how bad it was. And when I reflect on it and you know, talk about and think about what really happened in my career, you know, and why I didn't get to where I wanted to go, you know, a very, very big part of it was because of what I'm just talking about. You know, I you know, this whole concept of self-awareness, I didn't really know you know, there was so many things I didn't know about myself. I my dad was always my coach. I was away from home. I really didn't have a coach. Mm. You know, I wasn't sure what to really practice. I didn't have a great plan. I didn't really have any defined goals. It was just take your clubs and go and see how you could do. And I think that's with a lot of the top performers, certainly, that I work with. It's funny because I work with these people and I sit down with them and you know, they open up their desk and out they pull out all their goals. They're all written down. So, you know, I never had that. I didn't know how these emotions were impacting me. I didn't know what they were, what the emotions were. So I couldn't do anything about it. And all these little pieces that kind of separate, you know, the really top people from the average guys like I ended up being in professional golf. These are all little pieces that I didn't have. And they're all related to, if you want to call them the mental game, yes, emotional game, whatever you want to call it. It's all blended together.
So I need to go back for one little thing that you slipped in there.
Yeah.
While you were describing that blow-up hole on 18, and you were saying before you hit that second shot that went errant and hit the old man in the shoulder, you said, my mind was blank. That intrigues me because so often I speak to mental coaches that say, you can't have things going on. You gotta clear your head before you step up to the ball and not be thinking about all these different shot thoughts. And when you say your mind was blank, you mean like you just even – you looked at the ball and had no idea what you were supposed to do. What did that mean?
Yeah, exactly. It was almost like I forgot what I was supposed to do. It's okay. Like, you know, it was really funny, Fred, when I got up on the first tee that particular day, okay, I realized how many people were watching me on the first tee. There was a grandstand, and then people were lined up waiting for Norman on the first hole. So they were lined up almost right down to the green. And my first thought, my major primary thought when I got up on the tee to hit that ball was don't miss it. Now, I've played golf since I was 5 years old. I've hit a million golf balls.
Right. Have you ever missed a golf ball in that time?
Never.
Right.
Never.
And that's what came into your head?
Yeah, and that's where the fear and you're just, you know, you're letting all these outside influences impact you. And, sure. And that's exactly what happened. Instead of just standing up and saying, I've done this a million times, just smoke it down the middle, that didn't happen. Instead, I get up there, I'm looking around, there's people everywhere. I'm saying, geez, just don't blow it here. Just, you know, and I'm sure this happens to a lot of people. I mean, I know it happens to a lot of people because I talk to people about it every day. They get up on the first tee, their buddies are watching, and they're thinking, just don't miss the ball or don't hit your normal slice or, you know, whatever the negative approach is. Instead of getting up there and saying, the people watching, the weather, any of these influences around here have no impact on what I'm going to do. I'm just going to do what I can control and hit the golf ball to the best of my ability. So, you know, it's amazing. And believe me, this stuff happens at all levels. It happens to you see, like, for example, you saw Kenny Perry this year in the Masters tournament. Mm. And you saw him play, you know, 70 perfect holes almost. And then when the pressure really started to mount and he thought about what was going to happen to him if he won that event, and a lot of stuff rushed back to him, and this is stuff buried in your emotional memory. In 96, he had a very good chance to win the PGA Championship, and he bogeyed the last hole, which was a par 5, to end up losing the event. And I'm telling you, these things come back. These things come back to you. If you don't deal with them and you don't clean them out and clear them out, they will come back to you.
Sure. Well, there was moments, other moments in the 2009 tour that seemed to bring that up. And possibly, you know, we can only speculate, of course, but Tom Watson on the final putt of the Open Championship.
Yes, and you know what? That's a good point. You know, Tom Watson, he was a fantastic putter when he was a younger guy. In fact, he was unbeatable when he was the Player of the Year. I don't know how many times on the PGA Tour because he was such a fantastic putter and could really close the deal. But then it sort of became his Achilles heel a little bit as he got older. So perhaps, yep. That's a very good possibility that, you know, he had about 10 or 12 feet to win the British Open, and you saw it wasn't a very good attempt at all.
Well, what I'd like to talk about is, and I think this is your focus of teaching, is the emotional element of the game. We talk about the mental side of the game a lot, but we really don't focus much on the emotional side and what kind of impact that has on your psyche and your round of golf. And as a matter of fact, it's so crazy that I got an email just this past week from Tom Jones.
Right. Okay.
You know, it's not unusual to be.
Unusual to be emotional.
That's right. And he's writing from Woodstock, Maryland, but his question is, are there any mental exercises that can be practiced at the range or indoors to help avoid or overcome blow-up holes?
Overcome blow-up holes. Well, the inconsistency is often a result. I know for me, when I was playing professional golf, the inconsistency, I know, was a result of me not having a control or a management or a direction, certainly of my emotions. And you know, it's really
interesting. It comes all back to the emotional part.
I think so. You know, it's really interesting, Fred, that I think a lot of people don't know is that emotions trump thoughts, meaning that emotions shape your thinking. When I draw this little performance line or performance grid, you know, you start with emotions, then you go to cognitive or thinking, then you go to behavior, then you go to performance. So the outcome is your performance, and at the very beginning, certainly is the emotions, and the emotions trump and shape your thinking. So if you've got, you know, people ask me a lot of times in my workshops, etc., you know, how do I stop negative thinking? You know, I say to them, well, it's not quite as easy as popping a negative thought in your mind, like think positively or you're great or you're the best. That does, in my experience anyway, does absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it's
really
almost like the emperor wears no clothes.
Right.
You're great.
Right.
You're great. You're so good. You are so good. You are so great. You're a miserable wreck. You are awful. you suck. You can't. It's like, no, you're great. You're great. No, you're great.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's like the little guy on your shoulder.
Exactly. On either side of your head.
But you really have to understand, you know, your emotions, your emotional memory, your history, all those things, because when you get in a situation where you're under pressure, and it's always under pressure where things get ugly. Well, you know, if you go to the Masters tournament or you go to any major championship, you watch the pros practice and you go to the practice rounds. Like every year, normally I take a group to, it's a leadership team, I take them to the Masters tournament, and we stay Monday and Tuesday, and then we leave on Wednesday just to watch the practice rounds and to have a little session with their team. But, you know, it's really interesting. We go out and we watch these guys. We watch them putt. We watch them chip. We watch them hit balls. We watch them on the course. We watch them learn the golf course. We watch them talk. Everybody's relaxed. Everybody looks great. Everybody is at their best. You know, normally guys are peaking for the major championships, so typically everybody looks pretty great. I always ask my group, to pick who they think is going to win the tournament. And then we get together on a phone call on Sunday and chat a little bit about it after the tournament and just laugh about how far away we are from actually picking the winner. And, you know, you can't tell from the visual, the talent, how a guy is playing typically. You know, in the practice round days, you can't tell because the pressure becomes so intensified when it goes from Thursday to Friday to Saturday, and then finally Sunday. There's very few guys who can really, you know, get it together and close the deal when the pressure intensifies and the distractions are at the peak on Sunday. And that's the sad reality and the tragedy for many athletes is some have this tremendous talent and are great, but, you know, when it doesn't really count. But when it does really count, they struggle. And it's a good example. This Masters thing is a very good example because we're never close to picking the winner. You know. Typically, we leave Tiger Woods out, and mm-hmm. we pick other players. But, you know, you'll see Ernie Els, and he'll look, wow, look at Ernie Els. He looks amazing. There's no way he can't do well in this tournament. Right. And then you'll see him at the end on Sunday, you'll see 37th place or something, you know. So,
well, you know, there are people, and I think that men have been accused by women of this for a long time, is that we can compartmentalize our emotions. We can just shove it aside and you know, just not deal with it right now, where women, their emotions are all over. They have, it controls them in many ways, and I'm really sorry if I'm offending anybody when I say this. This is my own personal experience now. But, you know, that emotions can take over a lot of different things where men are able to just like, okay, wait, I don't need to deal with that right now, so I'm not going to. But on the golf course, there's so many different things going on in your head and on your body that your emotions, and again, we don't talk about it as emotions, but they really do can have a tremendous impact on what happens during the round.
Huge. Absolutely huge.
Oh, fascinating.
You know, strong negative emotion can decide whether you're going to be, and that's the whole idea of the book, whether you're a contender or a pretender in any kind of performance. You know, it's interesting, Fred, because this whole Tiger Woods thing, you know, Tiger Woods, probably the last 2 to 3 years, has had a tremendous amount of emotional turmoil in his life and things he's had to deal with. The death of his father, getting married, the whole emotional, you know, turmoil of getting married, you know, having kids, having basically the PGA Tour on his shoulders every week, you know, and that whole burden becomes greater and greater, I think. So,
who's Tiger Woods?
Oh, he's some guy. He's a pretty good
I've never
player.
Heard of him before.
I'll send you his bio. I'll send you his major championship bio.
It's called Encyclopedia Bio. Yeah.
But anyways, you know, you can see over the past 2 or 3 years on the golf course that Tiger Woods has become angrier and angrier. And you could see in Australia, that one little incident in Australia really showcases and highlights, outside of all the, you know, all the swearing on the course and you know, he really gets angry sometimes on the golf course. But in Australia, he kind of threw his club down and went into the crowd and hit somebody. And they passed his club back, and he just went over and picked up his club like nothing ever happened. Didn't look in and see that it hit a kid, you know. Didn't do anything. Just kind of move forward. And these sorts of indicators to me are really show that Tiger really hasn't dealt with a lot of this emotional stuff that's gone on in his life, and it's impacting his performance. Mm. Now, you can say that Tiger did have a great year last year, and by anyone's standards, he did. He won golf tournaments, but he didn't win any major championships, and that anger factor, especially in the major championships, that frustration, the anger, these things that are coming out, because I believe he hasn't dealt with a lot of these other things on the other side, and when he does deal with those things, I think it'll free him up a little bit, and he'll not only perform better, but he'll enjoy it more too.
That's really interesting, because you know there's been speculation, you know, where's Tiger, yeah. And some have said maybe that he's in a rehab program for sex addiction. Maybe, in fact, he's in a program to help his emotional state.
Well, I hope he is, and I hope he doesn't think that he's beyond that, because he's a human being, and everybody needs that. We're all emotional beings. We're driven by our emotions, and you have to deal with these things. That's like in the book, I ask people to do an emotional inventory and write down all their big negative experiences and all their big positive experiences, and you know, work on that a little bit, because if you're a top performer, you're an elite athlete, or whatever it is in your life, it doesn't matter. We're talking about golf today, but it could be anything. When things get a little hot, when the heat's turned up, when the pressure's turned up, this is going to come out. So you really need to deal with it. You know what's really interesting too, Fred? We assess people in emotional intelligence. So we've assessed thousands of people at conferences, my workshops, golfers, everybody. And the average person, out of all the people we've assessed, 8 out of 10 people do not have an adequate level of self-awareness. 8 out of 10. If you can believe it. Wow. Meaning that people don't really understand how their emotions impact them. And unless you do, I think it's you're going to have difficulty, certainly on the thinking side. And that goes right into behavior. You see Tiger's behavior that we just talked about, and you can there's so many other examples. And then it goes right into the performance. So it's that chain of performance there. And like I said, it really starts with back at the emotions, and the fact that a lot of people don't recognize those emotions. And, you know, there's a lot of other attachment to self-awareness too, your values, your goals, you know, expectations, a lot of things tied in there that we work with people on. But it's a big area for sure.
Well, it's amazing. And I think that is what the Golf Smarter team members are all going to be interested in, is how to fine-tune their emotional toolbox and figure out ways to, you know, as Tom was asking, we don't have obviously a specific mental exercise to avoid those blow-up holes, but it's an entire, there's a book. And John wrote this book. It's on Amazon. Actually, we're going to have this book available in our Golfers Mart of golfsmarter.com. It's called You Are a Contender, and it's written by John Haim. Really interesting stuff. John, we wish you the best of luck. Give us a couple of websites, or one website you'd like to share with us that everyone should go check out.
Sure, Fred. And just to take off a little bit on what you were just talking about, in the book we've developed some tools for some people: emotional spiral, emotional inventory, and emotional caddy, that can kind of help you deal with your experiences in a better way. And in the book, we also talk about, or I also talk about, I guess I wrote it, so I shouldn't say we, but I wrote the book. So
blame it on somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. So I talk about, you know, the differences between contenders and pretenders, and what pretenders do and what contenders do, and what the significant differences are. But
yeah, I love that part.
I think what makes the book fun is that we do have solutions for people and some tools that they can kind of grab onto, and that's what I was trying to do. So you can, if you want to learn a little bit more about the book, for sure, www.youareacontender.com would be great. And like you said, it's I'm not sure if it's out in the bookstores yet. It just came out December 15th, but I'm up here in Canada, and it's in the bookstores here, and I know it's on Amazon.com, and there's some great reviews for some people who have already read the book on Amazon.com, if you want to have a look at that.
Great.
And
well, again, if you go to that link in the Golfers Mart, it'll take you directly to the okay, so here's the deal. It takes you directly to the Amazon page, but we get credit if you make the purchase. So, you know, we just get
Perfect.
30 cents for the book. So.
And Fred, you do a great job on this podcast. I just want to say that.
Oh, John, that's very nice of you, but unnecessary. Thank you. I appreciate that.
No, it's you're good at what you do, and the time goes quickly, so that means that that I'm enjoying it, so it's great.
Well, I hope the audience feels the same way.
Yes, me too. Perfect.
John Haim, thanks so much. Youareacontender.com. And also a new website that you are developing that you should check out, newedgeperformance.org.
Yeah, and let me just say very quickly about that. That sort of is a really interesting piece we've used as a follow-up to the book. So in February, people will be able to go on there, and they'll be able to have their emotional competencies, the key performance competencies that separate average and outstanding performers, they'll be able to have them assessed on there. And then we also have a coaching tool online, and that's at www.newedgeperformance.org. And I think people will find that interesting. There's an online brochure up there right now to show people, you know, how we can help them and what the tool will do to help you. And then the tool, we're just getting the technical bugs worked out. The tool will be up there in February to go and have a look at. So,
and you know what crosses my mind when you bring that up is if that any golfer out there, any listener out there has, say, teenage children that are athletes.
This is huge.
I got to believe if there's a way that you can communicate, because I know how tough it is with teenagers, but if you can communicate with your teen to expose them to something like this, if they're having, again, if they're athletes and they're having issues with their emotions getting in the way of their performance, and who hasn't seen a teenage athlete let their emotions get in their way, this may be a way to give them a tool to work on their own so they don't have to do it with you, that they can maybe realize for themselves how valuable a tool this could be for them.
You know what? And if you can introduce it now to a young person, sure, it's going to help them so much down the road. So they'll learn it through the game of golf, but it's going to be vital to them in everything they do, because I work with MBAs, et cetera, too, and they have great technical skills, but often this is the piece that they're missing to be very, very successful. So it's a very useful thing to know how to do.
It really is very useful indeed. I know that there are a lot of Golf Smarter listeners who have kids and teens who play golf. And frankly, there are young people who also listen to this podcast that really should take heed as to what John is saying. Think about all those times we lost our temper or got frustrated in a round of golf. If we had better control of our emotions, not just our mental game, I'm sure you agree that we'd have greater success on the course. You Are a Contender is the name of the book, and it's available in our book section on the Golfer's Mart at golfsmarter.com. Now, how would you like to win an amazing prize that will take you to one of the most entertaining and fun PGA Tour events every year? Now, formerly it's known as the FBR Open. You've heard of that. Now it's called the Waste Management Phoenix Open, and it's going to be played again at TPC Scottsdale in late February. Not only do we have VIP tickets to put you in the skybox on the 16th hole. Remember that time that Tiger got the hole-in-one on the tour and he went crazy and the entire crowd on that par 3 was just going out of their minds screaming? That's the 16th hole at TPC Scottsdale. That's where your VIP tickets will be, in the skybox. So you're going to have an amazing view the whole day to watch a party like you wouldn't believe. Actually, I was talking to a nephew of mine who lives in Phoenix. He's been in Phoenix for a long, long time. And he says that the biggest party in the area every year, bar none, is this event, now known as the Waste Management Phoenix Open. The good news is that this year, for the first time, the final day of the tournament will not conflict with the Super Bowl. So the place will be rocking more than ever. So, as I said, the prize package includes a pair of VIP tickets to the Waste Management Phoenix Open, a round of golf for two at Eagle Mountain Golf Course, 3-night stay at the Gainey Suites Hotel, dinner for two at Morton Steakhouse, 2 hours of a free Segway ride, or even a Segway tour of Scottsdale with a tour operator, and there's more. Okay, now you must be able to go to Phoenix, Arizona on February 25th through the 28th. It is a weekend. And you have to provide your own round-trip transportation. Deadline for entry for this drawing is February 1, and we'll announce the winner on the show the next day, February 2. So make sure that you're listening in as soon as we publish this show. So if you win, you can make your plans to go. If you can't go to the event, then we'll pull another name. So make sure that you go to golfsmarter.com and click on Enter Contest. This promotion is being sponsored by the Scottsdale Convention and Visitors Bureau. We thank them very, very much for their support of this podcast and hope that as a team member, you will click on their link at the top of the contest page. If we can prove to them how much support we get from our Golf Smarter community, then I'm hoping we can get something else out of maybe more prizes, more opportunities to play golf in the desert, a Golf Smarter adventure. You know where I'm headed with this thing. So please show your support and let's all get together. But I hope you win. It's going to be an amazing thing. Next time up, I will tell you about what I get to do. Here's a tease. I'm playing in the Pro-Am. That's what they're telling me so far. And, you know, I'll believe it when I see it, but I'm playing in the Pro-Am on the Wednesday before. So that will be an episode two. Hopefully. Keep your fingers crossed. We have lots of details about this promotion on our Golf Smarter group on Facebook, in addition to many topics of discussion and updates from our global community. If you're on Facebook, please join in the conversation. We have a fan page, but most of our activity is actually on the group page. So join them both and participate. We hope you can join us there. Speaking of the Phoenix Open, it was on this date in golf history that began arguably one of the most spectacular seasons ever and started that weekend. On Saturday, January 12th, Byron Nelson teed off and eventually won the 1945 Phoenix Open. He then went on to log a record 18 wins over the next 11 months, including an astonishing 11 in a row. Next week, for members only, we talk about rules and etiquette with the creator of DuffyMcGolf.com. If you have any questions, quotes, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at GolfSmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.